All right, this episode of Extreme Health Radio is brought to you by Mountain Rose Herbs. And I got to tell you, this is the best place to get bulk organic herbs and spices at super, super, super good prices. This is where we get all of our shaga, our reishi, our medicinal mushrooms. You can get resins and burnables, seaweeds, smoking blends, sprouted seeds, peppercorn, seasoning blends. You can get herbal teas, green and white teas, chai tea, herbal tea, flowering teas, teapots and presses, all kinds of cool stuff. Mountain Rose Herbs is really, really just the place we love to go to get all of our stuff related to medicinal mushrooms and teas and stuff like that. So if you go through our link, extremehealthradio.com/mountain, we'll get credit and you'll get some really cool stuff. And we're also brought to you by Barf World Dog Food. Now, I'm sure you guys have heard us talk about this particular product. We just love it. Maggie's on it. She just is. It's really good because it's a raw dog food that includes the bone, which is very, very important because dogs in the wild would always eat the bone of the animals that they killed, as well as the entrails. And that's super, super important because there's an acid alkaline balance. Usually when dogs are eating muscle meat, or if we're eating muscle meat, we're getting a very acidic diet. But when you eat the bones, it becomes alkaline. So it becomes this perfect balance. Maggie has tons of energy. We just took her on 4 walks today. It's so incredible. This stuff is really good. Your dog will thrive on it. They have chicken, beef, lamb, and combo, so you can kind of switch up your dog's diet, which would be much more natural. So if you would like to check out the Barf World dog food as well as Mountain Rose Herbs, you can go to extremehealthradio.com/447, and there will be links to both of those products on that page. ExtremeHealthRadio.com/447, or they're both in our store as well. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us here on another episode of Extreme Health Radio. Really appreciate it so, so much. Today we have a great show with Dr. Vera Tarman. We're going to be talking about food addictions. And I read recently that 70% of America deals with food addictions and issues relating to food, which I would probably say it's maybe even more than that. Everybody has food addictions, even people that are healthy. You know, very neurotic about their foods, and it's kind of bizarre that way. But we're going to be talking with Dr. Vera about her journey with all of that and her website, addictionsunplug.com. Seems like we've been doing a lot of shows lately about addiction, so we'll be introducing her in just a second. As you guys probably know, we don't do show notes anymore. In lieu of doing more shows, we're doing 3 shows a week, and we appreciate you following us. In order to do those 3 shows, we had to kick off the show notes. So if you would like to take notes during the show or write anything down, you'll have to do it yourself. But if you want to listen to this show on our website, you can do that excuse me, at extremehealthradio.com/447, and you can listen to the show, get links to her website, and all of that. So that'll be available at extremehealthradio.com/447. And so Dr. Vera Tarman has been working in the field of addiction medicine since 1994. She's been accredited with the Board of Addiction Medicine in 2004, and she's been the medical director of Renascent since 2006. She's a regular contributor to call-in TV show Living Clean, Living Well, and was co-host on Addictions Unplugged, which is also her website, addictionsunplugged.com. She's also the author of a book called Food Junkies: The Truth About Food Addiction. So, thank you, Dr. Vera, for being on the show today. We really appreciate this.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be asked.
So, are you in? You're in Canada. Is that right? Is that correct?
Yes, I'm in Toronto, Canada. Right, what we like to think of as the New York of Canada.
Oh, okay, awesome. So you're on the East Coast. And how's the weather up there this summer?
Dreadfully hot if you don't like the heat, which I don't. It's very hot, although it's very nice today.
Yeah, it's seeming like that all over the United States, too. It seems like the massive heat wave's going on around here, and I think we're all dealing with it. So I was looking at your website, excuse me, and I was reading that stat before the show. About 70% of Americans, at least, is probably, I mean, it's probably the same in any Western nation or maybe anywhere in the world, but I'd probably assume Western nations, that 70% of people have food addictions.
Well, is that about 70% of the American and Canadian population are obese. We actually don't say have food addictions, although I think that would still be a fairly accurate story. Can I elaborate a little bit on that?
Please, yes.
Yeah, because what's happening is that even, I'm glad you mentioned this, even in your intro, even people who aren't food addicts, who generally are healthy and well and have, you know, are very well-adjusted people, mm-hmm. If you're living in today's society, and what I would like to say, and I'm not the only one, living in a toxic food environment, basically the processed food industry, you're addicted to food because that's the point of that kind of food. It's meant to be addictive. It's meant to be luring in such a way that anybody has a hard time putting down, you know, a couple of chips or a couple of bites of a cookie.
Yeah,
it's almost impossible.
They're too tasty, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it would be accurate to say that if you live in our society, you're somewhat addicted to food, but it doesn't mean that you're a food addict. And that's a distinction that I want to make later on in our talk.
Ooh, yes. Okay. So let's make sure to hit on that. Being addicted to food is not the same as being a food addict, but I would say that it would make sense though, if 70% of America is fat.
Yeah.
Then those people have to be addicted to food, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you're eating the foods that are making you fat. Even if you're managing to keep a fairly low caloric content, mm-hmm. if you're eating the stuff that we're providing you, then you're addicted to it.
You know, I found interesting over the years is that even in the alternative world, it's just so pervasive. You see people that are thinking about food, they're eating only 30 bananas a day, or they're doing all these crazy diets, and they're very neurotic. And I understand that if someone's, you know, maybe sick with cancer and they're trying to do some alternative things, mm-hmm. but just the average everyday sort of person who's really into health, it can become a neurosis, can't it?
Oh, for sure it can. And just the fact that you think that you're eating healthy food, like gluten-free something or other, or, you know, you're eating vegan, does not mean that you're actually eating healthy. It's got a lot more to do with how many sugars and carbs you're intaking. And a vegan can be eating the worst of unhealthy foods. So a lot of this is labeling that we really have to look behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. We did a show with Dr. Betty Martini, I think her name was, a few years back, and she was talking about MSG and how addictive MSG is, and that's basically in everything, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, so that's an example of how the food industry will, engineer food so that even the most, like I said, well-adjusted person who has no addiction anywhere is going to have a hard time saying no to something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is very challenging because, you know, whether it's sugar or carbohydrates, you know, you flavor those up and all of a sudden you're just, even if you're really, really healthy, you're still craving that stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really bizarre because, you know, there are some, you know, treats in the raw food world where, you know, it's coconut and it's agave and chocolate and it just tastes amazing. And, you know, I could see people being addicted to stuff that's supposedly healthy too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can talk about the sort of dynamics around why that's the case, you know, whenever you're ready to do that.
Yeah, let's do that because I want to get into your background and how you got started. But yeah, let's talk about the dynamics of why that is.
Well, I mean, it's the way that I like to suggest it, and this is how even a normal, well-adjusted non-food addict can get lured into this. I mean, we have a kind of happy ecosystem of what works well in terms of our body and the food environment. And if we were all eating the way we were eating maybe 200 years ago, there would be much fewer problems than there are today. And part of it is the food industry for sure, but also it's that even, like you mentioned, 30 bananas, like even natural foods, if we eat the way our body is meant to be programmed. I mean, you know, we've got normal sugars and normal carbohydrates and whatnot. Our pancreas, our insulin system, like the whole, the way the body works well if we eat basically like we would have eaten 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. If a person is eating 30 bananas or 30 jujubes or something where there's a high sugar content, basically beyond what the pancreas can handle, beyond what the brain can handle, you start to go into what's in sort of overdrive of various, like we have a lot of checks and balances, things that make us desire something. I want to eat something because I'm hungry, and then at a certain point I'm full and I don't want that food anymore. Mm-hmm. But if I'm eating something with a lot of sugar in it, which our brain is programmed to like because it's energy dense, then the desire to have that overbalances my desire to stop because I'm full. And that's got to do with the reward pathway in the brain, the dopamine. It's got to do with the checks and balances, which now become unbalanced.
Mm-hmm. Is there any connection, do you think, to the beneficial microflora and bacteria in the gut?
Well, we're discovering now that that also is impacted. I mean, the whole issue about, first of all, obesity and now about addiction just becomes more and more complicated the more we know more about these things. And so the microflora is sort of the latest piece, you know, in this last couple of years, looking at how sugars will foster the bacteria in the gut, which will actually promote obesity and will promote the preference for these foods. I mean, this is new information that only adds to the fuel. We don't even need to look at that, but adding that to it, it just becomes astounding that people, like 100% of people, aren't addicted because there are so many dynamics that are working sort of against us. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a snowball. The momentum is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. The more obese a person becomes, the more a person is addicted to something. Then they become more obese and more addicted because all of these phenomena kick in and make things worse.
Yeah, you see it on these reality TV shows where people get to be so big. I'm curious with this kind of idea, with food addiction. I'm curious because I've known, and we've all known, people that have had sort of addictive personalities, and they get off of, you know, maybe they stop smoking and then they get interested in alcohol, or it kind of goes from one thing to another within their life.
Absolutely. And that's actually how I got started in this business. But finish your question then, Renal.
Yeah, no, I'm just curious what the difference is between someone who has an addictive personality, and obviously food is going to be a part of their addiction at some point in their life because we all have to eat, versus a person who is doesn't have an addictive personality, not necessarily, but they'd get wrapped up in the addiction to food through, is it their own psychosis or is it a part of, or is it the food industry? You know?
Yeah, I think that the normal eater, the person who doesn't have an addictive history nor has a sort of preponderance towards addiction, you know, is kind of gotten walked into the snare of the food industry. So they're stuck on foods, and if they actually stop eating those or eat a healthy diet and you know, really pay attention, they will probably be able to back off and eat normally and moderately. But how I got into the business, because I'm an addictions physician, is that I saw either people who ate the way my addicts ate, my cocaine addicts and my alcoholics, in the same way with the same kind of behaviors, or I saw addicts who put down their drug, because I work in rehabs, and saw them eating the same way as they use their drug, that I thought, holy cow, there's got to be a connection, and it's a no-brainer. So I started to look at the literature, and there wasn't very much literature when I started. Now we're seeing literature coming out. But at that time, which was like 10, 15 years ago, mainly people talked about it in the community, you know, mm-hmm. hey, I'm an addict. But we weren't finding it in the professional literature.
Let me just make sure I heard that correctly. So, because I know sometimes when I listen to radio shows and podcasts, you kind of zone out for a little while. But so you're saying that, let me just make sure I word this correctly. You were looking at people that had food addictions and they were eating a certain type of foods that were feeding that addiction. And then you would in turn look at patients you're dealing with that were coming off crack or some sort of drug. And then when they came off that drug, they started eating those same foods. And that's when you put the connection together.
Yeah, that's right. You heard that right.
Okay.
And sometimes they would say, you know, doc, I never ate like this before. Why am I eating like this now? Mm. You know, like, so when you look at a normal eater who's stuck in the food industry, you know, they might eat a couple of muffins a day and they didn't want to. Mm-hmm. When we talk about food addiction, we're talking about that behavior, but exponentiate that by not two muffins in a day, which is a lot, right? Mm-hmm. But 20, 30, 40, or 20 muffins and now, you know, three Häagen-Dazs tubs of ice cream and now another four boxes of ice or of Krispy Kreme donuts. Like we're talking like a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And so what happens is that person, their ability to say no, and they are wanting to stop, but their ability to say no is so defeated that life becomes impaired. Mm-hmm. And when we measure addiction, it's the parameters of impairment. So if a person smokes a cigarette once a week, they're probably not going to say they're addicted to cigarettes. They just have a social smoke once in a while when they're out. Mm-hmm. But if they're smoking, you know, 20 a day and they're starting to get sick, basically their life is becoming impaired. Well, they're an addict. And similarly with food. So I would see patients with, you know, impairment because they're not able to work because they've been fired from their job because of their alcohol. Or here's a better example, crystal meth, which is the most devastating in my experience of, you know, you can't be a crystal meth addict for long and maintain life.
Mm-hmm.
Putting down that drug and, oh my God, all they could do is eat. And, I'm talking about eating in the way that I just mentioned, nonstop. Weight gain. Oh my! Life becomes impaired. You don't go out because you'd much rather stay in with your Netflix and your three tubs of ice cream.
Are people that are typically addicted to crystal meth? Are they when they're addicted? Are they typically very skinny and then they put on a bunch of weight when they start eating?
That's exactly what happens. And same with crack and cocaine. I mean, we actually call it the Jenny Crack Diet.
Wow.
You know. People, like, they put down their substance and they're so grateful that they put it down. Their family's happy. Everybody's just so delightful. And then all of a sudden they start gaining weight and gaining weight and gaining weight. And I've had people say, you know what, if I have a choice between my drug or sugar, I'll pick the drug. And that is actually a cause of relapse in the addiction world is people cannot stand the weight gain and the lack of control.
Don't they say that sugar is more addictive than cigarettes and everything else? I mean, it's one of the most addictive things.
I mean, it depends on who you say they. The professionals won't say that, but certainly people will say that. And that's been my experience that, it is more addictive, partly because it's everywhere. Like, you can't get away from it, right?
Yeah. I mean, you could theoretically get off all drugs and you can live a life where you're not offered drugs, you don't need to take drugs. But when you're eating food,
you're done with those people.
Yeah. When you're eating food, I mean, you got to eat. So it becomes like a daily battle.
Exactly. And you got to hang out with people who are going to offer you three or four times a day. Just think about how many times in a day you've got sugar in front of you. Just go to the local Starbucks and there it is.
So what were people doing? It's so mind-boggling because at one level, like you know, you understand why people are addicted because these foods are so crazy today, like Twinkies and all these you know, chemical foods.
Yes.
But then, you know, what were people doing? If they had this addiction, you know, 300, 400, 500 years ago, there must have been people that had some sort of mental disorder like this. Back then, how would that addiction manifest itself, do you think?
Probably through alcohol, through whatever it was that was available to them at that time. And, you know, the people who had the money would have probably done, you know, we see stories of people who have, you know, the rich basically who would get gout and they would get hypertension and they would get all what were then considered the, I forget what that's called, the moneyed diseases.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? But now people get gout all the time. It has nothing to do with money because, you know, what is gout? But, exposure to rich foods like meat and, cheeses and stuff like that. So now we start to see it in the non-rich population because we're essentially eating the way that they would have eaten a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. I've actually wondered about that. You know, if we didn't have the food industry, we still have addictive people. Right. What would they have done? I actually think that they would have, like I said, become the alcoholics, or they would have done things. I mean, this is a really interesting side, if you want to take this route, is that, you know, the addict personality is the person who's very high risk, likes to be on the edge. Those are the people who are the explorers and the inventors. And, you know, they always drank, but they were the writers. Mm-hmm. They were the artists. We don't have anything to explore anymore. What do people do? Well, they explore crack.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to say that. It's unfortunate. We've kind of reached our limits of what we can be adventurers in and ability to use that risk in a positive way.
Yeah, you're right. Because we think about, you know, the world's becoming smaller. You and I are talking via Skype. You're in Canada. I'm in America. And, you know, this ability to sort of do these things and watch videos from people all over the world.
Yes.
You know, back then they didn't even know what the world was or how, if it was round or flat or, you know what I mean? So they didn't have these. Yeah, I can completely understand that. But now that everything's sort of been figured out, what else is there to figure out other than just, you know, this is the way life is. And if it's not good, then you're going to reach for something like food or drugs.
Exactly. I mean, then you could just join the army or you could, I guess maybe that's where some people are going. You could become a pirate. You could become an explorer. You could do all sorts of crazy things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating because you've seen people. I've seen the shows on TV and I don't have TV anymore, but you know, I'll see it, you know, if I'm at the gym, sometimes it's on like these, Biggest Loser type shows or whatever. And it's like people's addictions to food. And I know this was the case for me before I changed my diet. I changed it, radically in 2003. And I was always a person who really loved to work out in the gym. And people would always tell me, how can you work out 3 days a week religiously like this and do all this? And I always said, you know I have to fix my diet. I know it. But working out was so much easier to me than fixing my diet. It was just, fixing my diet was the hardest thing I knew I had to do, but I knew I had to do it. But working out in the gym 3, 4, 5 days a week was easier than that.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about food. It's so linked to our survival mechanism. It's so linked to our comfort. I mean, it's intended to do that so that people do eat. Otherwise, we wouldn't bother eating.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding in your work that, I don't know if you still, it sounds like you're not working with the people that take drugs anymore or alcohol, or are you?
No. How I'm working right now is, that's my job. I work at, actually 5 different treatment centers, and they're all, sort of new recovery people that are coming off the street or off their workplace or whatever, coming and staying in a treatment center for 3 weeks to 10 weeks.
Okay.
But actually what's happened is, one of these centers has opened a food addiction program. It's a pilot project that we're doing so that I actually get to see those folks too, people who are coming in just to quit sugar and carbs. I mean, we have a specific diet that we call an abstinent diet, and I get to see them as well.
So if you were to sort of compare the people that you see with addictions to food compared to any drug or any alcohol, what would you say is the most addictive, you know, how would they compare to each other?
It's as you said earlier, I actually think sugar is the most addictive.
Wow.
Because it's everywhere. Like you can't, you know, one of the phrases we use in the addictive realm is people, places, things. You know, you got to stop the triggers that will cue you because a lot of these cues are subconscious. You know, you have willpower, but willpower can't stop you from thinking about, a Cinnabon when you walk by and you smell it. and by the way, that's intentional.
Right.
So you can deliberately choose not to walk into a bar and smell the beer or you know, the patio, but you can't with the others. So it becomes, I think they're equally addictive, but because the sugar thing is so ubiquitous, we don't have the support. Like even if I say, look, I don't eat sugar, I'm still going to get offered it sometime in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have willpower and there are parts in the day when you just can't say no as well as you can at the beginning of the day, for example.
I want to get your take on this because it's kind of been my mindset, and I want to, I'm just curious as to what you think about my mindset, because I'm wondering about people and sort of the self-love component. And when I look at, and as well as the understanding what food does to you component, because I'll walk by a pizza shop or something like that. There's actually a pizza shop right next door to the gym, and it just smells amazing. The food just smells so good. But when I smell that, the first thing I think of is, I don't think of that as actual food. And then I think to myself, okay, well, I've got a particular direction in my life that I'm going, and I want to accomplish certain things, and I want to be the kind of person I want to be. And, you know, if you're going to be like a superhero, or if you're going to achieve great things, I'll ask myself, does this food facilitate that? Mm-hmm. And then I'll say, and then I understand what it does to my gut. And then I have a certain level of sort of self-love and self-respect that that's not what I do. And so I, although I think it smells great, and I would probably eat it if I had to, but I don't look at it like it's something that's going to facilitate the direction that I'm going. So I'm wondering if, you know, how does the mindset with people, because people will just take food just based on taste. How do you change the course of how their mindset, and is my mindset, is that healthy? Is that good, do you think?
Well, you know, mindset is important in that it will make you make the right choices. But if you're living in a food environment in the way that we are, there's more compelling desires that are larger than just mindset. And this is actually why I have a problem with treatment programs that are only focused on like mindful eating and you know, cognitive therapy, where you can work on issues so that you feel better, have higher self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Those are all useful. They're actually more useful once you're in recovery and you want to stay in recovery. But you see, here's the thing about food addiction and my work is that what we're saying is that people, especially when they've crossed the line and they've become addicts, so like, you know, you're the smoker who's now a smoker. Once you reach that point, you can't just have a little bit of something, because if you introduce the substance into the body, what happens is that the brain gets, it's already hyper, it's basically primed for that substance. And you have a bigger reaction now than you would have had 20 years ago or another person, where self-will and self-esteem might make a difference. So a person like the World's Biggest Loser, no amount of good self-esteem, even if they were living in a fat-friendly society and, you know, absorbed all those messages about it's okay to be fat and all that, and feel good about themselves in a bikini or whatever, even so, the moment they eat something, it flares up that want to have more. And that's much larger than self-esteem.
So is that whatever chemical
physiological thing that's happening on top of the psychological?
So the physiological thing, no worries. No, the physiological thing that's happening, whether it's happening in the gut or the brain or both, probably both.
I think it's both.
Now, whatever's happening there, is that possible to be healed and to have a regular relationship with food where someone doesn't have to avoid wine forever, but they can have a glass every once a month and be okay?
Now, this depends on who you talk to. So you're talking to an addiction doctor, and even in the addiction field, there are some addiction doctors who will say it might be possible, if you actually weren't really an alcoholic but a heavy drinker, that you might be able to enjoy a glass of wine one day. But if you're an alcoholic and you're coming from the vantage point that I am, which is I believe that some people have to be abstinent and that once you become an addict, there's no going back. What I'm saying is that there's been a change in the brain, a vulnerability that has exceeded the ability that you can go back, so that you will never be able to have one glass of wine because you'll always want more. Think about it like this. If you, everybody is allergic to poison ivy to a certain degree. And the more you're exposed to poison ivy, the bigger the allergic reaction becomes. So that if you live by a poison ivy field, at a certain point, just walking by and having the spores, waft by you, you can have such an allergic reaction that you got to be rushed off to the ICU. And there's no going back from that. That person's developed a hypersensitivity, like super. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about, a person's allergic to alcohol, or food, that's what we're talking about. It's a hypersensitivity that they have to stay away from it because even the slightest bit will make them flare up. And the flare up, what we say in the addiction field is it's a phenomenon of craving. You want more. You have a little bit and, oh my God, that's delicious. Now I want more.
So is it... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, is it safe to say that the more a person acts on their addictions early on, the more they give into it, the sort of deeper the cut is, if you compare it to like a wound. So the more they act on it, the more, the deeper the cut is and the less likely then that later on in life they can actually have a healthy relationship with something?
You hit it right on the head. So okay. We are making food addicts of our kids because we're not letting them moderate. But you're older. You're not a 16-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. You probably, I don't know about you. I don't want to speak specifically, but people, who have had childhoods where they weren't eating only sugar through the form of cereal and orange juice and stuff like that, unhealthy stuff, people who actually, if you didn't actually get that far advanced, yes, I do believe there's a possibility to have a normal relationship with food. Because you haven't gone that far so that hypersensitivity is developed to that degree.
That makes a lot of sense. That really does. Because if you're not, if you don't damage or injure yourself to a certain extent, at some point it's like, the death of a thousand cuts. Eventually you die and it's not any one cut, but...
It's like the diabetic, that's the type 2 diabetic that can diet control it. At some point, if they lose enough weight, their sugars, they can moderate their sugars and they don't need their meds anymore. But if you reach the point where you're needing insulin, chances are you've already, the insulin receptors have been damaged to the point where you're probably going to have to be on meds the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. You may be able to get off of them or have not be on insulin, but just meds. But, it's almost like, well, I guess we've kind of belabored the point. Mm-hmm. You can go over a line and then there's no going back.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that people are addicted to sugar in any and all forms, but you don't find a lot of people that are addicted to, chicken or, things like that.
Right. Yeah, because it doesn't have the same dopamine pull to it. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that bizarre? Chicken or really any other food.
Well, it's sugars or it's carbs that break down into sugars. And it's not even fats. Although fats with sugars, oh my God, that's very addictive. But not even salt. I mean, that stuff is slightly addictive, but the compulsion, the way that people are eating, it's the combination with sugar. And it's got to do with the fact that our brain, is fueled on sugar. I mean, I know it's also fueled on ketones, but, it's certainly fueled on sugar. And so we have already born our human brain, like everybody, is primed to want energy-dense foods like sugar and fats. Mm-hmm. And so, proteins are sustainable, but they're not brain food, basically.
So what would a healthy outlook on food be, do you think?
Well, are you talking about a regular person or a food addict? Because that's slightly different.
Yeah, maybe compare the two.
I mean, I think that just basically, as other people have said, I'm not alone in this, just eat real foods. Mm-hmm. I think it was Michael Pollan who said that. Just eat the way that we basically don't eat processed foods. That would be the bottom line for most people. If you are going to, if you have problems, then you're going to have to start watching portion control and specifics. But for the outset, I would just say eating fruits, vegetables, proteins, fats that are not processed, and you're already starting from a good template. If you're a food addict, you might have to go further than that. In fact, you do have to go further than that and actually limit the amount of even sugar that you're eating in fruit, like to one fruit a day, and carbs, no more grains, no more flour. Like, you have to be a little more extreme.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I realize now that, you know, we do what we do and you sort of understand how the world works a little bit more, is that you start understanding, you know, a long time ago, there was a guy I worked with, and he was much older than I was, and he would kept telling me, giving me financial advice, and he was telling me that, you know, he pointed to my back pocket, and he said, you know that back pocket right there with your wallet in it?
Yeah.
Everybody is competing, and they're fighting to get into that wallet of yours.
Yes.
And I just thought, oh, wow, that's so interesting. Everyone's trying to get me to open that wallet.
Yes.
And the same is with food. People think, oh, it's just a piece of bread, or oh, it's designed in a very specific way to get you to do certain things. It's not something like, even with a fruit, you know, high in sugar, even some fruits are hybridized and genetically modified and things like that. Yep. But food, the processed food is designed in a specific way to get you addicted. And people don't realize that there's an agenda behind, you know, that piece of Wonder Bread, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, food engineers, that's their job, just to get you to buy that particular brand.
So what are they doing in food? Like, say something that's relatively innocuous, but not. Something like a piece of white bread, what are they doing to it? Are they adding MSG to it, or what's going on, do you think?
Well, they don't even need to do that, because I mean, it's got to do with the glycemic index and how things break down. And you know, our brain, our body is and our body, and when I say that, I'm talking about insulin and how much sugar a body can safely take in. It's probably like, you know, like a bit of grain, you know, rice or a potato or some kind of fruit. It can handle that in terms of the insulin surge and in terms of the dopamine surge, which is the pleasure in the brain. But now you introduce white bread. It's just like a glass of orange juice. That's like, think of all the sugar, the white carbs, which break into sugar very quickly. That's the glycemic index, is how quickly things break down into sugar. You're getting like not one piece of fruit in orange juice, but 10 pieces of fruit. Or in white bread, you might be getting equivalent to the sugar content of, a few pieces of fruit. You're getting more sugar ultimately quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's more than what our brain and our body was programmed for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
really, so programmed for a hunter-gatherer type of a thing. And so we're seeing diabetes is like the physical manifestation of that, and food addiction is the mental manifestation of that.
So when you're working with people, I'm curious about their mindset when you talk to them, because like I've heard recently that, you know, we're supposed to be eating roughly 25 grams of sugar a day. And, you know, I would say probably less than that is what we're supposed to be eating.
We don't have to be eating any of that. I mean, that's just the World Health Organization giving in to the food industry. I don't know if you know this, but our liver will make sugar if we need it.
Mm-hmm.
We do not need to have any extra sugar.
So when you tell people, like, you know, you can read articles on the internet about the dangers of sugar and things like that. And for me, and for probably most people that sort of think rationally about these things, those articles will be very impactful, because you don't want to get cancer, heart disease, all these things that sugar affects. When you talk to a person who's addicted to food, does telling them the effects of what they're eating, does that have any effect on them?
No, it doesn't. Not usually. What does have an effect is if I say, especially the people I see, because I'm seeing people who are addicts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're there because their addiction has messed up their life to the point where they're willing to give up 3 weeks or even just an afternoon to see me. I mean, you know, it's not just, oh, gee, this is a problem. This is like such a problem that I'm willing to give up 3 weeks of my life to sit in a residence with a bunch of guys I don't know.
Wow.
And so they're obviously suffering from an obsession, whether it's alcohol or food. And so when I tell them, they already have read everything that you're talking about. They've already tried every diet or they've tried to control their substance already. What the message of hope that I can give them is, do you want to live so that you don't obsess about your muffin that you're going to have tonight, or not one muffin, but your bag of food, mm-hmm. or your bottle of wine that you have to have at night before you can get to sleep. Do you want to live in such a way that you don't need that stuff anymore? That's when they're willing to listen.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, because if you take, people know they're addicted, and they know that if they remove the addiction, they're going to become healthier. And that's sort of not something they're focused on, but they're probably all focused on can I remove this insatiable desire to eat? Yeah. And there'd be, I'm assuming their eyes would just light up.
Yeah. I mean, usually what it is more is they're terrified to give it up. How will I get to sleep without my bottle of wine at night? How will I get to sleep without eating something with my TV tonight? Mm-hmm. I don't know how to do it, because they've already tried. Mm-hmm. And some people will have lasted until 3 a.m. and then they give in, or maybe in a couple of weeks and then they give in. And what I would say is, actually, you will be able to live free of this obsession at some point.
See, that's where it becomes very interesting to me. Mm. You know, because if you can be free of this obsession, I mean, that to me, if I was an addictive personality, you know, you're battling an inner demon.
Yes.
You know?
That's it. You'll quieten that demon.
I'm curious about the success rates, if you call them that, between the addiction that you do with food and the addiction you do with alcohol or drugs. Are there differences, and what are they?
Well, the different, I don't, you know, to be honest with you, because this is a new area, and the concept of even seeing food as addictive from a professional point of view is really new. I mean, I don't know why it is new, but it is. It's a professional industry. The medical industry, the dietary industry, the nutritionists don't really, I mean, you're being, you know, very kind to be so open about talking about it in this way. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't want to hear this message. And so I don't have a lot of success because I haven't been treating that many people. But I can tell you that, in general with addiction, the success rate's not very high. I think that the numbers are generally about 10 or 20% of people who seek treatment. But if you actually look at the people who are, if you actually look at it, the people who do treatment and continue 6 months to a year later, either doing 12-step meetings or they're still in their counseling, they're still doing something, they actually do quite well. They re-engage with life. They do all the things they're supposed to do. What we say, do the do things. Get rid of the friends who are still using, all that kind of stuff. They do quite well. And similarly with food, if you speak with people, including the people that we've seen in this last year with the pilot, and they're still following the food plan that we gave them, they're still connected, they're still doing the do things, they're doing very well. And I would say it's actually comparable.
How much is there a difference between changing, you know, when someone comes in to see you and they spend 3 weeks with you, obviously you guys are going to be working with them with diet and things, but aside from the diet, you know, you've been bringing up during the show, changing your triggers and the social impact and your friends and things. Aside from the diet, how many things are you working with people in terms of a lifestyle, that they also need to change?
Well, see, the fact that we're talking about this from an addictive framework opens up a whole tool of a bag of tools that weren't previously available. You know, if you go to your family doctor or your internist or your dietitian and say, look, I got a problem with food, usually what's the tool you get? You get the calories in, calories out model of work, do more exercise and eat less. Mm-hmm. Or you go to the dietitian and they'll give you a nice little diabetic diet, which doesn't work because you keep falling off of it. And then if you go back to your doctor, you say, hey, buddy, it's not working. And they might send you to an eating disorder clinic and teach you tools in like cognitive therapy and mindfulness and working through previous trauma, because it's often a high rate of trauma in a person's background. You get tools there that often don't work either. Then now we're finally starting to see this as an addiction. We have a whole other bag of tools. And so when a person comes into a 3-week program here, we give them their abstinent food plan, because they obviously have to eat, but they're eating basically foods that are non-addictive and healthy. And then we give them on top of that all sorts of tools. So they're going to be things like recognizing triggers. You know, you write down all the triggers and you learn how to avoid those. not easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people, places, things. What are all, like I said, all the cues? Then you learn how, when you're confronted with those triggers, what do you do? What are the tools that you can use to deal with that? And it's not going to be self-esteem because it doesn't work in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Self-esteem is great for how to stay abstinent, but in the moment when you're faced with the whatever it is, you need to have tools, which are usually really, they're tools that we learn, that we teach in the program, and they might be things like you just do an affirmation. You try to distract the mind. You try to get... they're basically tools of distraction and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But they're a whole set of tools that you wouldn't otherwise be given. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the things that will keep you sober, food sober, over time.
That's interesting.
That's what we teach people.
Yeah, that's interesting that you would do that because there's probably, or you would make that distinction because, it's sort of like, starting a business or something where you need to have a bunch of different skills and
yes.
you can have the ability to be motivated, but
yes.
but you also need to have the skills to be able to do what you're doing. And so motivation is great, but it's not the whole piece. And so self-esteem.
You need those little steps.
Mm-hmm. So when someone's in the moment and they're at a birthday party and they're being offered ice cream and cake and things like that. You're saying that the self-esteem piece is not necessarily as relevant for the people you've noticed.
Here's an example. That's a great example. So let's say I'm a food addict and I've been to the program and I've learned the tools. Mm-hmm. So now I've been invited to a party. So an addictive tool kit would be, all right, I know I'm walking into a dangerous situation because party means cake. So I'm going to call somebody. It could be a sponsor. It could be just a friend, a food buddy, whatever. And I'm going to say, look, I'm in trouble. I'm going to a party. I'm going to tell you that I'm doing this. And here are the things I'm going to do. And at the end of the party, I'm going to call you back. So you're introducing accountability.
Okay.
And the intention to be sober. That's already the first step. And recognizing that you could be in trouble. Second step, when I go to the party, I'm going to tell the host, please don't offer me anything there. And you might say, how can you do that at a party? Well, another tool in addiction is we call it first things first. Sobriety rules over even being polite. You're being offered the birthday cake. It is more important for me to say no than to offend you. Now, that's an addiction tool. We're taught that. You go to a party and you're offered wine. You learn how to accept it and put the wine glass somewhere else before you drink. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so you're going into these dangerous situations with tools and intention.
Strategies.
It's kind of like, I guess, a lot of people, how they say, don't go to the don't go to the grocery store when you're hungry kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. That's another example. That's a perfect one.
Yeah. So you're saying, okay, I'm going to be offered food. I guess you could say the same thing about a party or something like that where you're going to be offered food. I mean, why wouldn't it be a good idea to just stuff your face with some healthy food before you go? And then you're too full to eat. Yeah.
Well, there's that one. Or there is, I'm going to go to the party with the intention that I won't eat, but I'll bring my own food.
Ah, okay.
There's that. Or I will speak to the chef or the person and say, could you put a particular food aside for me and I'll have that instead of.
So in the same way that we talked about earlier, giving into temptation and addiction early on in life and continually throughout your whole life sort of giving in each time to these addictions. In the same way we talked about that, is it also possible that the more times people go into situations like we were just talking about with intention and becoming successful at going to a party and not drinking or eating.
Yeah.
Does that do something to the mind that says, hey, I'm worth it or I feel good about myself?
Absolutely. Yes. And that's the piece. And now we're talking about recovery. Because if you're doing all that stuff, that means you're not eating that stuff. And now you're in recovery, which is a lifetime process. So how do you stay in recovery? You have to feel good about yourself. That's why self-esteem is really important, to ensure that you continue to feel worthwhile enough that you're making the efforts to do this. Because it's a lot of extra work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, recovery is work. It's a discipline. And, we often say you shouldn't try to do this stuff alone because our willpower and our motivation wanes. It's like exercise, right?
Uh-huh.
You get a trainer, you don't really need that trainer to teach you anymore. That trainer is there to make you get off your butt and do what you're going to do.
Right, right. And I was just going to bring that up because it's a great comparison, at least for me, because I do still go to the gym, you know, multiple days, 3 or 4 days a week. And I noticed that when I go to the gym on a regular basis, the exercises, even though they're difficult and I may be adding more weight each time, because I do it so often, it's somewhat easy. But if I take like a year off or I take a, you know, 6 months off, all of a sudden though, the easiest, the lowest weight exercises are incredibly hard.
Absolutely.
That when a person continually chooses their health and their life and make good decisions, does the ability to resist temptation and addiction become easier?
Yes, it does become easier. And so a person, and that's part of the hope that I try to give the person at the beginning when they feel so daunted of how can I not live with these foods for the rest of my life? I say, you know, the first month is pretty hard. Actually, it's really only a couple of weeks. That's hard because you're coming off of the stuff and you're actually in physical withdrawal. Then maybe the first year, you're learning the tools and you're instituting them and you're going to feel awkward. And it's like, you know, your explanation about the building the weights up higher and higher. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, it becomes second nature to just say, you know, I don't eat that stuff. Thanks anyway. I really appreciate the offer. Like it just rolls off the tongue. And recovery becomes quite simple. So you have no obsession from food, plus the recovery actually becomes quite simple.
And people, I would imagine, that are having addictive personalities are usually not waking up that day thinking they're going to break an addiction, but it becomes something that happens very quickly in the moment. So when they're going through treatment, I would imagine many people would become impatient. They'd think, I want to be healed now. And I mean, essentially they're changing not just their microbiome and their gut and their physiology, but they're changing neural pathways in their brain. They're changing all these physiological neuroses that are happening in their body that I mean, 3 weeks is a good start, but it seems like it would take a long time to change all of that lifetime of eating that way.
Yes, I think that you summed it up very nicely. There's the whole physiological piece, and then there's the whole psychological and sociological, because you're also training your friends and your family. I mean, you know, with me, people just go, oh, that's the way Vera eats now. They leave me alone, because I've essentially trained everybody. So, I mean, and it does take a long time, but it's so worth it. Like, it gets easier after the first couple of weeks. Every week is easier and easier. It's not like you're suffering. Mm-hmm. You're certainly not suffering like you were when you were in the addiction.
I would imagine the first few days would be really difficult.
Yes, yes. And that's why I'm so happy that we have this program and that I wish we had more of these programs. You get through those first few weeks when you're actually locked up somewhere with support and lots of encouragement. Get through those first few weeks. And then, you know, when you walk out, people are beaming when they walk out. And I'm just hoping that they will continue doing what they're doing.
When someone's going through the situation there and you're giving them all the tools and the support and obviously the diet that is going to be better for them, are you also introducing things into into their body, like certain specific substances to balance out levels in their body, in their blood or anything like that?
No. I suppose that we could do that, you know, in terms of are there particular nutrients that we could offer. But the matter is if you eat a good healthy diet, like we suggest, it's about a 2,000 calorie a day diet. It's not restrictive. You know, we have the appropriate amount of proteins and fats and carbs, like healthy carbs, like vegetables. I don't think it's actually necessary to complicate things further. I don't know enough about the whole bio, like the whole sort of bacterial flora thing, but my sense is that if a person eats well, that will also readjust. And if more needs to be done, more can be done. But our experience is that just eating a normal diet, eventually within months, is fine.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, the bacteria, because like you said earlier in the show, that it's becoming quite the thing to talk about. And I recently heard a doctor speaking, and he was saying that he was on the show and he was explaining about how the microbiome and the gut and the beneficial bacteria, I think a couple hundred years ago, or the ideal is to have 1,000 different strains of bacteria, not just the amounts of bacteria, but different mm-hmm. kinds, 1,000 different kinds. And Western nations are down to about 300, which I would imagine would play an impact and a role in all this stuff, too. Yeah.
I wouldn't know how to fix that.
Yeah, that sounds like... I mean, people are doing fecal implants. Have you heard about those?
Yes, I've actually read about that. I haven't actually heard of anybody doing that.
Yeah, there's a doctor in... there's a doctor here that was explaining that to me. He got the, I guess, experimental data from a doctor in Australia. And what they were doing was working with kids with autism and having some incredible turnarounds. But eventually it would wear away. But after they would get the fecal implants, every time it would last for 3 or 4 weeks, their autism would almost be non-existent for a few weeks.
Uh-huh.
So there's a weird connection between... you know, this beneficial bacteria and food and addiction, and it's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I'm actually very interested in more research in that area. I find it very intriguing.
Yeah, because the people they were doing it with in Australia were carefully selected families and groups of people where kind of similar to, you know, maybe Amish would be here where they've had 3 or 4 generations of no vaccines and no flu shots. And so these kids were... you know, I guess able to donate their own feces to be, you know, part of this study, and just amazing. I mean, there's so many cool tools that we have. And I think what's going on is all the sugar that we're eating is somehow affecting that and, you know, causing all these weird imbalances, you know?
Yes, I think so.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. So when people come to your institute, well, first of all, let me just give you your website. Your website is addictionsunplugged.com. And when someone comes to your center, how does it work out for them? What's the process?
You mean like the intake process?
Yeah, like let's say someone wants to really correct their food addictions and they would contact you and how would that process start?
So they would call this, I mean, the center, it's a pilot project and it will end at the end of the year. So we're not actually advertising anybody to come, but just for the curiosity of what that would be like. I mean, they call and say, I've got a problem. I've heard about this food program. I'll do an assessment to determine that it's an actual addictive behavior, because we're not interested in being a diet program or helping people just to do a sugar detox. We're interested in sort of the extreme end, the people where their function. We're looking at the people who are, you know, 300 pounds, or maybe they're not that big, but they've lost their functionality in terms of a normal social life and a normal work life. Like they're usually isolated eating, or really struggling in some way. So, I'll do an addiction profile to determine that. And then we bring them in, offer them the abstinent food plan with all of these tools. And then after 2 weeks, they go out and we hope that they continue the tools.
Golly, I mean, I just see the people, and I see people so addicted in their personalities. I'm sure you've seen it through all your years of working with people that when they a family member takes away their phone or a family member takes away their sugary food or something, they just go ballistic.
You know, I would be delighted is that one of the people in your audience is thinking, hey, you know what? Is this a niche? It is. Like, you know, they're looking for some kind of business enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
To have an addiction center that treats food only, I mean, we get a lot of people and a lot of interest from people calling here to pursue that, because the need is so great. But the problem is that people aren't willing to see this as an addiction, so that they're not connecting those dots. But once they do, oh my God, like you would have so many people calling. Like we need more people in this field.
Do you mean the people that are addicted don't see it as an addiction, or the people that are on the outside looking in that don't have that addiction, like professionals?
Yeah, the people on the professionals, the people who've got the money to open a treatment center, the hospital system, the people, the doctors who would refer, the dietitians who would provide the food. We're just so stuck on, it's actually really frustrating for me when I hear so many people suffering to go, well, why, given this, is there not more professional attention to this? It's part of the reason why I'm on my bandwagon and wrote this book, is to say, look, this thing exists. There is the science. We've got to start connecting the dots so that we can get services offered. there's just not that many services that are being offered.
Well, it's a pretty unique thing too, because when you think about it, you're dealing with, I mean, you've thought about this, obviously it's your whole career, but you know, you're dealing with psychology, you're dealing with mental mindset, you're dealing with nutrition. So if someone's a nutritionist but doesn't have any understanding about psychological issues or spiritual issues, then you know, those are different disciplines that you're bringing to the table for everyone.
Yes,
that,
that's right. You know? And the traditional disciplines that have been at the table in terms of disordered eating, like problems with eating or obesity, have been the bariatric surgeons who say, all right, you got a problem, we'll slice up your stomach, take a little piece of intestine out, do some kind of surgery to take care of the problem so you lose weight that way. Or it's been the eating or the dietary industry, you know, here's how you can lose weight by going on Weight Watchers, or it's been the eating disorder clinic, and you know, like you're a binge eater or you're a bulimic or something like that, and they don't use these tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many disciplines all coming together for one thing, and it's so crazy because
but not food addicts.
Yeah, I mean, we all have to eat, and so you know, it's a daily issue. That gosh, what better way to build discipline in your life than to figure out how to overcome your addictions to food, right?
I think so, yeah.
It's like, I mean, like we said earlier, you know, you're dealing with this at least three times a day, not counting snacks.
That's right. It's what they say in the addiction community. You know, you take the tiger out of the cage three times a day. And a food addiction is all about how to make that cage safe and secure so that you can.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So your book, Addictions Unplugged, I'm sorry, Food Junkies, The Truth About Food Addictions, is that available on Amazon?
It's available on Amazon, and it actually, this 2 weeks ago, became available on Audible as well. I'm delighted because I'm somebody who loves listening to books when I'm doing my walk or my workouts.
Oh, cool.
So it's actually on audible.com as well. But yes, you can get it on Amazon for sure.
Do you do the reading for it, or is it someone that they provided?
No, I didn't do the reading. It requires too much much audio work, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, that can take up a lot of time. So are you working on any other books right now?
No. My baby is food addiction. So the book was written not because I love writing books. Writing a book is hard.
Oh, gosh.
I'm doing as much as I can in the field of food addiction, like doing speaks and educationals. And the book was just part of that larger picture. And it really does, for anybody who is interested in this area, it's a really nice overview of everything that we've talked about today.
You know, one final thing before we go, because I know you're busy and you're seeing patients. But I find that... I'm curious about what your take on this is, because it seems to me that people don't like to admit weakness. And so when you say, people don't like to say, yes, I am an addict, I'm an alcoholic, or I am this or that. Is there a stigma for people? Like, I think you did kind of hint at it, that people don't to admit food as an addiction.
Absolutely.
And they don't want to even say that, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yes, I mean, even myself, you know, when the book came out, one of the ways that we publicized it is that, our local paper did an interview on me, and the interview, big title, it was actually on the sort of front page of the Life section, said, "Hi, I'm Vera, I'm a food addict." And I looked at that and I thought, oh, that's great. I'm on the front page of the Life section. That's great. And then my second thought was, oh my God, it doesn't say, "Hi, I'm Vera, I'm brilliant." It says, "I'm a food addict." There's a level of shame there.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, well, you know, it's so ubiquitous. You just got to get over it, because everything is, like you said yourself, like, you know, everybody is suffering from this to some degree. And in my travels, talking about this, so many interviewers and journalists and all that sort of stuff all say, oh my God, I can relate to this. Like, once you start talking about it and the stigma is dissolved, especially when you see how common it is, you know? We think that pathologically, probably 20 or 30% of the population are food addicts. But I think that your figure, which, you know, the idea of 70%, is probably more accurate in terms of everybody feeling that lure of addiction and that difficulty to control.
Mm-hmm. I mean, shoot, I'm a food addict because, like, the way I know is I eat it all day long. I eat food every day. So
yeah.
I must be addicted to it, right? You know?
Well, I mean, there's one thing between eating, and there's another to be. I mean, the addiction piece is the obsession, you know.
Yeah, golly, that's so great. I'm so glad you're doing this. And wow, what a cool thing. So people are leaving your clinic after 3 weeks, and I'm sure you're seeing some great turnarounds.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the trick then is just, will they keep doing what they're supposed to do? But I'm really appreciative that you're talking about this and you're opening this up to a general population, because I'm really focused on the people who are sick, the ones who are actually seeking help. But there's that whole larger population that struggles, and that's the crowd that you're talking to.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, thank you for your work too, because without you doing, the work that you're doing and chose to do in your life and your career after all your education, we wouldn't be able to talk about it. So I appreciate the work that you're doing and helping people overcome all of these issues.
Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. All right, everyone. So thank you, Dr. Vera, for being on the show today. Really appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you asked me to come.
Awesome. Awesome. Hang on the line there really quickly. We're going to close out the show. I want to thank everyone for joining us. This was extremehealthradio.com/447. And if you know of anyone who is dealing with food addictions or unhealthy relationships with food, because we all have to have some kind of relationship with food, if you know anyone who's dealing with that, please pass on this show to them. In the hopes that maybe they'll get some benefit out of it. And we appreciate that so, so much. That's sort of how we grow, is all of you amazing listeners share our shows on Facebook or social media, and that helps people learn more and realize they have options for healing in their own health. So we appreciate that. And just as an aside, her website, Dr. Vera Tarman, is addictionsunplugged.com. Her book is Food Junkies, The Truth About Food Addiction. You can check that out on Amazon, I'm sure, or her website, addictionsunplugged.com. So we appreciate you guys so much. Really, really enjoy it. And let us know if we can ever help you. And we'll catch you guys on the next episode. All right. There you go. Dr. Vera Tarman from Addictions Unplugged Addiction. Let's see, is it plural? It is plural. Yes. Addictionsunplugged.com. I hope I said that correct on the radio show. Addictions Unplugged, and then her book, Food Junkies. I want to share with you guys a couple tips that I have been doing, and I'm not sure how many people that would be listening to this would be in the same state as someone who is, morbidly obese, or someone who's got a really, really bad problem with food addictions. Perhaps the majority of the people that are listening to this have that sort of moderate food addiction, maybe. Kind of the more normal type, like she was mentioning at the end of the show. One of the things that helps me is this principle I heard from David Wolf called subtraction by addition. I don't think he calls it that, but that's what I call it. Subtraction by addition. So the idea is just adding more and more healthy items into your daily life as possible. So you might start out with a green juice, and then you get into a habit of doing a green juice every single day for 30 days. While at the same time, what was great for me was to be able to not have any judgment about the food that I was eating. So at the time that I did this for myself, I was 27 years old, and I was addicted to obviously carbohydrates and bread and pasta and things like that. But, I just had the mindset, okay, I'm not going to worry about the food that I'm eating that's unhealthy. I'll eat as many pieces of pizza in a day as I want. I'm not going to even focus on that. I'm going to sort of chip away at this sort of mindset that I had. And so what I did was, even though I was eating ice cream and pizza and sandwiches and turkey and cake and cookies and all this stuff every day, my daily discipline was to do a green juice for 30 days. So when I would do the green juice, then I thought, okay, I'm pretty used to this. I like what it's doing to me. I didn't feel much different. I felt a little bit better. I just was happy about the fact, sort of proud of myself that I did that. And then after that, I said, okay, I'll do a green smoothie and a green juice every day. And then, after 30 days of doing that, I felt really good about myself. And then I started doing things like food combining, saying, okay, if I'm going to have my pizza, I'll have some other carbohydrate with it and a little bit of salad instead of this weird combination of food. So I began stacking these disciplines on top of one another and getting used to them along the way. And so while I was getting used to those addiction or those daily disciplines, I was also refraining from any judgment about anything I was doing that was quote wrong. And I realize that this is going to be completely different for someone who is really needing addiction help and work. And, you know, that's a different level of an issue there. But, for those that were just moderately addicted to conventional normal foods that we eat in our society, perhaps this could help. And so, I started building and stacking disciplines while at the same time getting rid of any judgment I had about food, anything I was eating. I just let myself do because I realized I'm sort of in this for the long term turnaround. You know, I wasn't trying to make a 21 day change or fast or anything like this. I was trying to change 27 years of addiction to food. You know, albeit moderate addiction compared to some other people, but I was very, very much addicted in my own. I know how much I was addicted. So when I started doing that and just reserving judgment, it's just sort of focusing on the daily triumphs, I guess you would say, of like, okay, today, what did I do today? Sure, I may have eaten pizza and had a Coke and had cookies and pasta and cakes and all this stuff, but I did my green juice, I did my green smoothie, and I had a salad, or I took my supplements. You can sort of determine whatever your own disciplines you want to do, but you know, you could pick this disciplines like that low sugar stuff, and you start feeling good about yourself. And eventually, over time, I gave myself an entire year to sort of cut all those foods out. And so, like we're talking about during the show, you can't necessarily think to yourself, "Well, I gotta completely cut out bread and pasta," because you know, you see these people yo-yo dieting, and they'll be off of it for 2 or 3 months, and then they get near something and they smell it. And I think that when you start introducing really healthy foods to your diet, like Dr. Vera was talking about, whole foods, healthy foods, organic foods, you know, it starts to change your physiology to some degree, and it starts changing your ability to crave certain things, and you start feeling good about yourself, and then you start, you know, it becomes a snowball effect. You start doing things in your life that maybe you're helping other people, and that makes you feel good. And so you get this, this feel good approach and attitude about life. And so the more success you have and the more victories you have every day, the more you start feeling good, and it becomes this whole cycle. So now it gets to the point where I don't even think about food. I have no addictions at all. I mean, I guess I do to some degree, like I said on the show, because we eat food every day. But, you know, if I do mess up, then I just, you know, if I have a little bit too much sugar, I'll take some supplements. Like, there's one really great one called Gymnema Silvestri that helps cut the amount of absorption of carbs into your diet. They usually sell those at health food stores. It's an herb, Gymnema Silvestri. And I'll take some probiotic supplements, you know, or if I eat, you know, too much sugar, I'll go for a walk. So I'm distributing the blood sugars throughout my system. And once you eat it, there's nothing you can do about it other than just love yourself and be, accepting of what you just did and move on to the next meal. So, there's things you could do even if you do eat too much sugar. So, anyway, hopefully that helped you guys out a lot. That was addictionsunplugged.com, and this was extremehealthradio.com/447. And I do want to do one thing before we close out the show. I want to thank our two latest patrons. We really appreciate you guys supporting us on Patreon. Patreon is a little service where you can donate on a per podcast basis, and you can set a monthly max. So if we do, you know, 12 shows a month instead of 4, you know, if you donate $1 a show, you'll only be charged $4 instead of 12. So, Marla Smith, and Marla also bought a sauna from us. So we hope, Marla, if you're listening to this, you like your sauna. And also Mark, Sosonowski, also was kind enough to join us on Patreon. And, please consider doing that. If you like what we're doing and we've brought any kind of value to us, please consider donating on Patreon. It really helps. You know, people donate $1 a month and, or $2, $5 a month, or, it equals to that depending on how many shows we do, but you can set your cap. And some people donate 25 cents a show, and we do 4 shows a week, 4 shows a month, and it comes out to $1 a month. And, it just really, really helps. And so if you like what we're doing and you want us to continue to do it, that helps us. So we really appreciate you guys so much. We'll do it for free. We're going to continue to do it, and we're going to continue helping everyone in the world with their health and, everything they have going on in life. So, but your help is greatly, greatly appreciated. So consider doing that. There's links on our website on the right-hand side to donate via Patreon, and it takes only just a couple minutes to, actually about a minute to set up an account. If you have Facebook, it'll just log you in automatically. So that's a great, great help. So thank you, Marla, and thank you, Mark. We really appreciate that so, so much. Thank you to all of you guys for just listening and being a part of what we do, and for sending in your emails and for sharing our shows on Facebook. You guys are just awesome. We appreciate it. And thank you all, and we'll catch you guys on the next episode.
Hey, everybody. This is Josie, Justin's mom. Don't tell him, but I know he would absolutely be really happy if you would sign up to his free weekly newsletter. And don't forget to share this with all your friends. This is the Buzzing Bumblebee signing off.
That was so good.
Hello.
Oh my gosh.
No material on this blog is intended to suggest that you should not seek professional medical care. Always work with qualified medical professionals, even if you educate yourself in the field of live food, nutrition, and alternative medicine. I'm not a doctor, nor am I offering readers medical advice of any kind. None of the information offered here should be interpreted as a diagnosis of any disease, nor an attempt to treat or prevent any disease or condition. While information in this blog is discussed in the context of numerous conditions, it can be dangerous to take action based on any information in this blog or to start any health program without first consulting a health professional. The content found here is for informational purposes only and is in no way intended as medical advice, as a substitute for medical counseling, or as a treatment/cure for any disease or health condition, and nor should it be continued as such. Always work with a qualified healthcare professional before making any changes to your diet, prescription drug use, lifestyle, or exercise activities. This information is provided as is, and the reader/viewer assumes all risks from the use, non-use, or misuse of this information.